Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 46 of the Wrestling Culture Podcast. Dave Musgrave here with Dylan Hales. Here this week to talk about everyone's favorite wrestler from the 80s and 90s, Lex Luger. I don't know why I couldn't come up with a better lead than that. But how are you, buddy?
I'm okay. I'm not bad. I'm excited to be talking about wrestling. And
yeah,
believe it or not, I'm excited to be talking about Lex Luger. And you know what? That's my awful stutter intro. But I'm going to because this is kind of a weird topic. So do you mind if I give like a brief preface for the reason why I wanted to do this show?
Yeah, I mean, it was your idea, and yeah. I jumped on it because I am a fan of the guy. But yeah, go ahead.
Okay, because this is admittedly kind of weird. I mean, we've done shows before on several different individual wrestlers. Kim Patera, obviously, Terry Funk, Andre the Giant, Hogan. And all of those guys, to one degree or another, are kind of obvious. Patera's not really obvious, but anybody who's followed my work online over the last few years knows that I've kind of geeked out on researching the guy's career. Luger is kind of a weird pick because I think he's probably one of the most polarizing wrestlers in history. Obviously, a lot of the people that work with him, a lot of his colleagues, even to this day, don't speak very highly of him. They sort of take any chance they can to take a dump on the guy and his legacy or lack thereof, I guess, in their eyes. He's very polarizing within the smart fan community or the hardcore fan community, whatever term you want to use. I think there's some people over recent years have probably started to give him more of his due than they did maybe, you know, 8, 9, 10 years ago.
I was about to say that. There's a real changing tide on him. So.
Yeah, I agree with that, but I still think he's polarizing. I certainly don't think there's people who've come around a whole lot on him. But, you know, this is weird because of all the guys who we could have done shows on, I mean, I've kind of solicited a request from people that are friends of the show or friends of me and Dave on and off over the last 6 months to a year.
With Dave and I believe is the proper wording.
I'm sorry, I'm not Canadian, dude. I'm not up with your fancy. I'm a Southerner. We don't speak correctly ever.
My mom, being a teacher, she always would do that to us. And my cousin Paul and I, well, our grandmother was a teacher as well. So, I don't know, we always do that joke with each other. So, anyways, go ahead.
What's sad is both of my parents are teachers and my mother's an English major, and you'd think I'd know better. But for whatever reason, any time I would ask, like, what wrestler would you like us to do a show on? Or sometimes this would be completely unsolicited. This has probably happened a half dozen times from different people. Lex Luger's name is like one of the first ones that come up, which I think is really fascinating. So he does have a new book out, which I have unfortunately not read, though I have glanced at it at work. And to be quite honest, it doesn't look like it's going to be very interesting. I suspect it's going to be probably pretty similar to the Dr. Death Steve Williams bio, which was lots of religious stuff with little smatterings of football and wrestling stuff throughout, and not really anything that would be of great interest to a hardcore wrestling fan. But that was kind of my excuse to decide to do this show now, because I do think he's an interesting figure, and he's somebody that, for whatever reason, a lot of people have wanted us to cover. And he's somebody who I think has had maybe one of the most unheralded interesting careers in the history of wrestling, certainly in the history of modern era wrestling. And we'll get into it. We'll probably try and start from point A and go through with some jumping around. But I did want to kind of give an introduction as to why I wanted to do this show, because it is admittedly a weird topic, but he's a guy who comes up in conversation a lot privately with people who are friends of mine and friends of the show. So I figured the excuse of him having a book out, even though I haven't read it and probably won't, was a good reason to kind of throw it out and go ahead and do the show now. So, I'll let you give your broad view thoughts of Lex Luger now, if you'd like to.
Yeah, I mean, I've mentioned many times, you know, I transformed into a super fan in 1988, and that was a good year to become a fan of Lex Luger, because that was, that in 1989 would be his biggest years. Or best years, I guess you should say, not necessarily biggest.
Yeah.
And you know what? I remember having seen him in magazines before that, and because my cousin collected the PWIs, and then just thinking, wow, this guy's pretty damn cool. First match I ever saw of him was Starrcade 87. And I don't know, that match with Dusty in the cage, people panicked, but I don't know, it holds a special place for me. And I just, you know, I've always been quite a fan of his, and I did, you know, get into the Smart Fan stuff in the 96, 97 of thinking, oh, it's not cool to like him, and I would criticize him a lot. But now I think, yeah, I was an idiot. So I kind of like him looking back on it. So.
Well, I'm sure we'll get into the details of all of that as time, because the details of our idiocy as youths, our younger folk,
yeah,
as the show goes on. But I guess we'll try and start with point A, which is always that's always very hard for me because I have to compartmentalize my thoughts and try and think in a linear way, and I'm one of the most scatterbrained people on earth. But I'm gonna give it a shot. I guess.
Yeah, there's three major things. He started in the fall of 1985.
Yeah.
And when I'm looking at the WrestlingData.com stuff here, it's really interesting. I didn't realize that the Florida territory ran shows in the Bahamas.
Yeah, they ran shows in various parts of the Caribbean. I think maybe not other spots of the Caribbean, but they definitely ran the Bahamas semi-regularly.
Yeah, and I mean, it makes sense because it was so close, but I don't know, I was just really surprised by that. But yeah, so I saw those, and you know, one of his early opponents is Wahoo McDaniel. And the three major things that define his first year and a half in the business in Florida would be Florida, Pro Wrestling Illustrated, and Ric Flair. Would you agree on that?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I would say, you know, when I think of early Luger, and I mean by early Luger, I mean pre-Crockett,
mm-hmm.
I think those things all kind of come to mind. You know, one of the things that I would kind of want to point to about him is he's one of these weird guys, and I'm sure somebody's going to come along and say, that's not quite true. But, I mean, for all practical purposes, Luger's one of these weird guys who kind of debuted as a top-of-the-card type of guy, or pretty close to it, not necessarily a main eventer, but in the mix or right on the periphery of the mix of being a main eventer. And really, he stayed that way for his whole career. I mean, you can point to periods later on, like the Stars and Stripes deal in the WWF and a few other brief blips where he wasn't necessarily in a slot you would consider like main event or semi-main event, but pretty much from the moment he debuted in Florida, he was in meaningful feuds and angles and storylines and put near the top of the card, if not on the top of the card. I know he also worked with Barry Windham during that time frame,
yeah.
Which stands to reason because in a lot of ways those two are, you know, I think a lot of people link Luger and Sting in their minds, and I know we'll get to talk about that later, but I also link Luger and Barry Windham in my mind. To me, all three of those guys kind of come in the same basket, so to speak. I think the Wahoo feud probably did a lot for him. He's also, you know, will be worth noting that he was trained by Hiro Matsuda, the same guy who trained Hogan. And I think there's a lot of, I don't want to say parallels, but I think there are, there's something to be said there's something to be said for the idea that if Crockett was ever going to have a Hogan-like character, it was probably going to be like Luger. I'll get more into that later. But that's kind of the stuff I would point to from that early Florida run.
Yeah, and I think I'm not seeing it in the results I have here, but I remember what I always read in PWI. Was that I think it was like within his first month in the business that he won a title. He won, I guess, a Southern title or whatever it was
a Southern title.
From Wahoo.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
it looks like
right away.
Yeah. So, I mean, you talk about him, what the hell am I trying to say? You talk about him being a main eventer right from the beginning. And, you know, I mean, I think they're putting him in with Wahoo for a reason. I mean, what better guy could you have to try and get him ready, right? So,
Yeah, and also maybe to make sure that you know, he didn't come out of this thinking that wrestling was bullshit. I mean, Wahoo was not going to be soft on this guy or anybody else.
No, no.
So if you've got an ex-football player who a lot of people have, you know, criticized for being less than humble, so shall we say, putting him in there with Wahoo will teach him a lesson real quick about how the wrestling business works, for better or worse. So, yeah, I think – and then, of course, probably his first big match was the Flair match at – was it Battle of the Belts 86, I guess?
Yeah, I'll get that up in a sec here.
I'm horrible remembering exact timeline stuff in this period from 86 through, like, 89, even though I've watched it, a lot of it a ton of times. I'm not particularly good at this, but I'm pretty sure it was – maybe Battle of the Belts. I know it was 86. He had the long Broadway with Flair, and that was kind of, in hindsight at least, because you never know how this stuff is really meant at the time. But I think in hindsight, it was sort of thought of as a, you know, a coming out party for this new kid. That was, I guess, maybe Luger's version of the Sting Flair match from the Clash of the Champions. Obviously not as iconic because it wasn't nationally televised, but
yeah,
sort of
he had a match against Flair in May of 86. I'm not sure if that was the Battle of the Belt.
I'm pretty sure that's at least, I'm not sure if it is either, but I'm pretty sure that's the show I'm thinking of. It was a 1-hour draw, if I'm not mistaken, and kind of a big deal in his career trajectory, or at least that's the way it was always portrayed in magazines and whatnot.
Yeah. Well, he wrestled Flair a number of times in 86, so I'm seeing like 4 times at least, and there might have been more. So, I mean, that's pretty cool that they were putting him in there with them. And, you know, Florida during that era was really pimped really hard by Pro Wrestling Illustrated, and Luger was especially. Like, he was on the covers all the time, heralded by them as the next Hulk Hogan. I know other guys like... he had a number of matches with Flair before the Battle of the Belts, but the Battle of the Belts was on September 1st, 86.
Got it.
And that's where they went to the time limit draw in a 2 out of 3 falls match. I don't think I've seen that, actually. I would assume you have?
No.
No?
Or if I have, I don't remember it.
I do have it. I just haven't watched it. I felt the need to... It's one of those things where I had downloaded as soon as I saw it, but then, like, it's been years since I did that, and I haven't watched it, so.
You mean you had legally purchased them from the WWE archives?
That's exactly what I did. So, yeah, I had to legally purchase them and track them down through... I don't know, I guess Rob Naylor or something like that. And and then, yeah, anyways. but, yeah, so that was the big match then. And, you know, I remember Ed Gantner was really big, a guy that yelled south from then. And, oh, look, he was actually you have Luger and Wyndham versus Kendo Nagasaki and White Ninja, who... If I'm not mistaken, I believe that's Muda, is it not?
It is Muda. Absolutely it is. Yep. Definitely yep. Was. It's kind of weird. Muda popped up in a lot more I shouldn't say a lot more places, but he popped up in a few places where I think people forget that he popped up during, you know, the mid to late 80s. He also popped up in Puerto Rico for a while.
I have a match actually with him and Miguel Perez Jr. for where it's hair versus hair.
Yep, he was there for a while. Or, I don't know if it was a continuous stretch or if he was brought in consistently for a while. I think he was on several tours, though. But, yeah, Muda was more of a staple in the States during that period than people remember, I think. Not that he was really, you know, a full-timer all the time from, you know, 85 through. That would be completely false. But he was around more than people remember.
That being said, he did his... He did more of the Kendo Nagasaki type gimmick, I believe, and broke out the high flying stuff once he got to NWA, WCW, whatever you want to call it.
Yes, that's definitely right.
Yeah. So, and one of the other more famous things with Luger during 1986, especially, would be the famous cage match with Bruiser Brody from.
I guess we should mention that.
What's that?
I guess we should mention that. I guess you have.
Yeah, that was September 1st, '86, where I don't know. I guess I'm not sure if it started out where I think Luger was giving him trouble with the finish, or he wasn't selling or something like that. I'm trying to read it here.
Oh no, that's complete bullshit. I've seen it.
I'm just trying to remember what led to it. That's all.
Now we'll see. This is one of those things where I don't know that we'll ever know what led to it. But this is a perfect example of kind of – this is something I kind of want to point to about Luger being underappreciated and how his reputation, I think, is – you know, the polarizing thing and how his reputation got to be so negative. It's very possible that he was a prima donna. I think he get – you know, Luger – and I don't know this for sure, but he may have been the very first guy – to have a guaranteed contract in wrestling. I'm pretty sure he's one of the first guys to have an agent, if not the first guy to have an agent, which isn't really surprising because he came out of pro sports. He came out of pro football. My thought is...
I say good for him, you know.
I do too, but my thought is that this was not well-liked by people, and I could very well see somebody like Bruiser Brody in particular not liking things like that and also thinking that Luger hadn't paid his dues and just typically being... you know, the stereotype of what I think a lot of people think of Bruiser Brody. But in the match, I mean, basically what it is that Luger goes after Brody and Brody doesn't sell. Brody doesn't beat his ass. I mean, that for a long time, that was the talking point that you'd see is that, oh, Brody basically stiffed Luger and Luger ran away scared. Well, what really happens if you watch it is Luger tries to work. Brody decides he's not going to sell anything, and Luger says, forget this, and leaves. It's really that simple. You know, I mean, why it happened, I think, is... I don't think we'll ever know the answer to that. I know there's probably 100 theories that have been, that you'll see people speculate about that, but I don't know that you'll ever really know the answer for that. Because, I mean, why did Brody do all kinds of the stuff that Brody did? You know, ostensibly it was... stick it to promoters who are ripping them off or to teach young guys lessons and shit like this, but it could have been just that he was a prick. We don't know.
All of the above.
I tend to err on the side of wrestlers
Brody
in conflict
being a
with
prick.
Well, I was going to say I actually tend to err on the side of wrestlers being right in conflicts with promoters, and that includes Brody. And to a large degree, I actually like the fact that Brody gave the finger to so many promoters who were so quick to give it to other wrestlers. But in an instance like this, I think it's pretty hard to defend that. I can't foresee any way you would defend that.
It's still fascinating to watch, though.
Yes, very much so.
And I do believe, I'll check here, I believe it's on YouTube as well.
It certainly was for a while. I don't know if it still is, but I know it was for at least a little while. You know, and not long after that, he was out of Florida. I mean, that was...
Yeah, he ended up going into Crockett.
Yeah, I mean, that was...
Yeah,
that
there
was
it is. Yeah, just put in Luger versus Brody, and you'll get it up on YouTube there. So, yeah, you know what? One thing I just realized that we should probably mention about him. It's something that you don't even think about, but it's the only thing you can think about the first time you ever hear his name, is that it is taken from Lex Luthor. But that's how entrenched he became, as you know, knowing him so well, is that actually I think when you hear Lex Luthor now, you're probably more prone to think Lex Luger. I mean, unless you're
I think wrestling fans are. I remember it's funny because I was a wrestling fan before I knew anything about comics, and I remember thinking that Lex Luthor was actually named Lex Luger as a kid. I had it backwards.
Yeah, I remember my cousin telling me that Lynyrd Skynyrd actually wrote the Freebirds song about the Freebirds. Because I knew them first, right? I knew of them first, so.
That's awesome.
Yeah. My cousin also told me that that you know he would come up with stuff like that. Hillbilly Jim had been WWF tag team champion on his own, and he defended them on his own. You know, kind of stuff. So.
I like how everybody.
And eventually,
has
I just learned he was totally full of shit. You know.
Everybody has that friend or cousin who's like a serial liar. And sometimes they're actually good people, but they just feel.
Oh yeah, I know he's a good guy. He came up with some crazy stuff about wrestling back in the day. Like
yeah.
Blade Runners were such were such big heels that the fans called them Stink and the Ultimate Warrior. I don't think that's true.
No, I don't think so either.
No, especially since they were Flash and Rock at the time, I guess. So.
Alas. Terrible. They were.
Yeah, it was actually very early January, and he actually managed to fit in like a pretty full schedule in Florida before going to Crockett. But he ends up there in January, and I'm not sure when he joined the Horsemen.
He basically debuted with the Horsemen, I think. I think originally, and I'm going off memory here. I admittedly did not do nearly as much research for this show as I should have, although I did do some. My memory is that Luger debuted as like the muscle guy for the Horsemen, but he wasn't officially a member.
Yeah, I think he was an associate.
Yeah, and then when Ole left, or whatever the hell happened with Ole, who the hell knows? There's another guy like Brody, you never know what happened. But when Ole was gone for whatever reason, whether that may be, that was when Luger became officially a member.
Yeah.
And that's kind of
they didn't know Lee Anderson face turn for a little bit there.
Yes,
which is
they
like
did.
What's that?
Yes,
they did.
That's what happened, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. So he was the first booted out of the Horsemen, and then, you know, as much as, you know, it's kind of ridiculous to have an Ole Anderson face turn, he would be the guy to have gotten out of the group. And you know, I some people that's certainly a version that I've heard referred to as one of the best versions of the Horsemen, but all three early incarnations were just tremendous. So
yeah, I think, I mean, honestly, I think they all have their positives. I think the version of the Horsemen with Flair, Luger, Tully, and Arn, in some ways, I think that was the most aesthetically interesting version because you had the clear power wrestler, the clear musclehead, right? I mean, which the group really didn't have before that. I mean, Ole was a strong man in his own way, and it was, I guess, in some ways a muscle figure in theory. But it's not, he didn't represent the muscle-headed mentality of the 80s the way Luger did.
No.
You know, and not even close. And then you still had Tully and Arn, you still had Flair, who all obviously had their distinct spots and roles. Whereas with the Ole role, I mean, it was still a distinct identity, but Ole always felt, to me, like the guy from a bygone era. Not even saying he was hanging on, because I think he was a very good part of the group, but he felt like the guy from the bygone era who was the most obvious man out of the people in the group.
Yeah.
Wyndham, I think, felt like, and I guess we'll get to that shortly anyway, but Wyndham, to me, felt like a guy who fit in the group, but was basically just almost too much like Flair. I mean, in no way would I criticize the inclusion of Wyndham, and I don't even think him and Flair were the same wrestler by any stretch, but I think in terms of how I felt about them, in my mind, I don't know, it's like you had these two really, really great heavyweight wrestlers, you know, and that's not really necessarily the dynamic that was there with Luger. I thought he brought a different dynamic and a different aesthetic to the group. I'm not even saying his group was his version was the best, because I don't know that I would say that. But it was aesthetically, I think, the most distinct, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think one thing that you can say about it, whether it was the best or not, you know what, I think part of where I get that is my brother thought that it was the best, but he liked roaring up guys, even though you would criticize roids, you know. But not that we know for sure that, you know, Lex Luger used steroids. But what am I trying to say? Yeah, so we, I guess one of the things you can say is that he definitely established a real archetype as far as the horsemen and even stables go. Like of, you know, because Sid Vicious later became a member. You know, you look at Batista later on in Evolution. So he really established that kind of archetype in a group such as this. So.
Yeah, I could see that. And I think that this, to me, this part is kind of the weirdest part of Luger's career up until, you know, the WWF run, I guess. But because he's a star, and it's clear that they're grooming him for something big, and you, but he's still new, right? And I mean, he debuted, just like in Florida where he debuted as a star, he debuted there, you know, aligned with the Horsemen or whatever. So it's kind of an oddball dynamic to me, because he was interjected right away into some kind of big-time storylines and stuff, which in and of itself isn't that surprising, but he was really young to the business. And again, I think that probably is another reason that his reputation was what it was. But I don't think this is a period. To me, this feels like a holding pattern in his career. I think up until he turns face in Crockett, which is not too terribly far after this, I don't guess.
No.
To me, it felt like he was in a holding pattern. It was like, okay, they've got this guy. They know they want to do something with him, but they don't know what.
Well, yeah, and one of the I was actually about to say this, but I'll correct myself on it before I say it, is that he's probably more of a guy that would have gotten pushed in WWE. But really, I guess when you think about it, I mean, Koloff, Nikita Koloff was there, and the Road Warriors were there. So they weren't exactly, you know, afraid to push some vitamin-heavy wrestlers.
No, they weren't. I think, I mean, to me, and we'll get into this really soon, but to me, Luger's problem, I mean, people always talk about Sting and how Sting, poor Sting, if he just had these chances and if the booking had been better. I mean, Luger was screwed over by booking and stuff like that far worse than Sting. I don't even think it's open for debate. I mean, because if you look at what Luger was able to do when he got reasonable chances, he actually grew money and he contributed really well. And you really can't say the same thing for Sting.
No.
So, to me, Luger is very well might be the most of the modern era. You know, the post-boom, post-territory era, Luger might be the guy most screwed over by booking decisions and nonsensical turns and stuff like that. I can't think of anybody off the top of my head who was probably hurt more by all that stuff. And we're getting close to where we're in the meat of that. So,
yeah. Well, and yeah, so he comes in early 87, a little ways into the year, Ole gets kicked out, and then the Horseman, and then he becomes the official member. And then, his first national level title, I guess you would call it, he wins the TV title from Nikita Koloff. And the U.S. title.
Yeah.
I
think he held the U.S. title five times. Over the years. I mean, that kind of became a title that you would identify with Lex Luger, or at least I did. He also had, not mistaken, the longest reign in the history of the U.S. title, that version of it anyway.
And in 1987, at that point, I mean, no wrestler would have been more identified with that title than Nikita Koloff, because he'd held it after the feud with Magnum T.A., then he became the babyface in honor of Magnum T.A., and, he'd held that for, I think he probably had it almost a year at that point, or most of the past year anyway. So they won that in the cage, and I actually have a tape of that, which I found just randomly in a record store when I was with my brother, and the name of the tape is Blood, Sweat, and Muscle.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, God. That, if I'm not mistaken, he won. I think JJ or somebody tossed him a chair or something, and they did. I could be wrong. I might be screwing this up. I get a lot of this Crockett stuff screwed up in my head, but I think that's what happened. And I actually think when he lost the title, they did basically did a similar finish, but with Dusty, if I'm not mistaken, you know.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened, actually, is
yeah.
that when Dusty won the title from him, a chair was thrown into the cage, and then Luger was supposed to probably grab it, and then Dusty was going to quickly DDT on him on it, but there's probably about a 5-second pause in between when Luger grabbed the cage and just stood there hunched over, and Dusty did the DDT. But it still looked cool to me.
But that was kind of, in any event, that's kind of a cool thing, because if I remember correctly, Luger won the belt when JJ threw a chair to him against Nikita, and then he lost the belt by the same means.
I'll have to brush up on my blood, sweat, and muscle to research that.
And I think that also set up, you know, I think all that is basically what set up Luger's face turn. You know,
yeah.
Not that I want to gloss over all of 87. If there's anything else in there you want to talk about, by all means. But I think
he was also a big part of, you know, one of the biggest things of 1987, which is very topical these days, the introduction of the War Games gimmick.
War Games, yep.
Yeah,
yep.
So that will be one way in which you could argue that the Luger version of the Horseman was one of the best in terms of that was a major gimmick that they got over.
And how big of a role Luger had in that directly, I think, is questionable. But Luger is a guy who popped up an awful lot of times in interesting scenarios where he's not necessarily the guy that you would credit as being in the most important slot, but he's oftentimes a guy who is in a really important slot, and it's hard to envision anybody else who could have been a better choice. And as we go through his career, I'm going to point to very specific occasions that I'm talking about here. Although I would say one example also would be, you know, the whole guaranteed contract thing. You know, being one of the first guys to do that and one of the first guys to use an agent is a really pretty important in the history of pro wrestling. Because these guys don't have a union, you know. So when you don't have a union, guaranteed contracts and stuff like that, that's about the best you can do. And, you know, so that's pretty important in and of itself. There's at least, I would argue, just off the top of my head, three more occasions where I think he may not have been the obvious star or most important figure in the scenario, but it's hard to envision who would have been better. And we'll get there.
I think we can probably agree that he was the most successful member of the World Bodybuilding Federation.
Yes.
Although I don't follow bodybuilding. But
I don't either.
Some of those guys might have gone on to be stars in that field, but
I don't follow it either because I'm not a pervert.
No.
Well, actually, I am a pervert.
Well.
not in that sense.
Not in that particular way.
Correct. I'm not obsessed with beefcake porn, is what I was getting at.
And we don't just mean Brutus's. Oh, man, can you imagine that actually being
no.
a thing? The Brutus Beefcake sex tape library?
Oh, good God. Well, he had a lot of downtime after the parasailing accident.
Yeah, the only thing more disturbing than Hogan applying suntan lotion to Brooke is Beefcake applying it to Hogan.
Okay, on that note, I'm going to force you to get back to Luger.
Okay.
I don't want to say
so. So, yeah, you go into, like, Starrcade 87. I'm not sure if he ended up leaving the Horseman. Oh, there's something else that's important that he did in 87. Is he was part of the second Jim Crockett Senior Memorial Cup,
yep.
teaming with Tully Blanchard and faced off against Luger and Koloff in the finals. So
Luger
great...
and Koloff?
No. Luger and Blanchard, I believe, faced off against Dusty and Koloff in the finals.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, no, Luger wasn't doing double duty fighting himself.
In his own match. He wasn't working a schizophrenic gimmick.
He didn't go all Bruiser Brody and start no-selling his own offense.
But, yeah, that was kind of a big deal. But,
yeah,
that
was,
again, I actually think, again, this is an example, kind of like with the U.S. title thing we talked about a second ago, I think this is an example of something that would become an even bigger deal the next year. Like, him and Tully losing in 87 in the finals, I think kind of, in a way, it was kind of like, and I'm not even saying that they had this plan. In fact, I'm quite sure they probably didn't. But in a way, it would set up, you know, the finals of the next year's tournament.
Yeah. Yeah. So the next year they had I think it was, if it wasn't right after Starrcade 87, it was probably fairly shortly after Starrcade 87 that he ended up leaving the Horsemen, you know, and he turned babyface.
Yeah, do you remember that angle, Dave?
No, I actually wasn't watching it by that time.
I actually had to brush up on this, and I actually asked Loss about this right before the show started. And our good friend Charles X, he's a member of the Nation of Islam. I mean, well,
yes,
possible. But anyway, he.
I see it now. So, anyways, go ahead.
Yeah, and basically, it was one of these deals where Luger was tired of JJ interfering in his matches and tired of, you know, non-wrestlers getting all this recognition. And they were, I think, in a Bunkhouse Stampede or something of that sort. And
very
early,
1988.
JJ wanted to basically have the Horsemen throw it for him so he could win it. And Luger refused to do that. And he got the typical Horsemen gang beatdown for his sins, and that's how he turned babyface. So he did his due diligence as a heel. I still look at 87, even though he did a lot of stuff, especially as you're running that down, I still look at 87 as almost a holding pattern for Luger. I mean, he was an important part of the Peach puzzle. He was a relevant player from day one, but I still feel like the whole thing was sort of done to set him up for the face turn that would come in 88.
I'm sure they had that plan from the day he walked in the company.
Yeah, yeah.
Or from the day they heard of him down in Florida.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny how royally, I think from here, from this point forward, I think it's almost shocking how royally they screwed this guy out. This was something that really should have been a catalyst to something huge, and in some ways was short term. I think it quickly turned into disaster for a variety of reasons, almost none of which, in my opinion, had to do with Luger himself.
No. But, And in fact, everyone, you know, people complain so much about Dusty's booking, but in all honesty, you could really attribute some of it to Flair in this situation, because, I mean, the story I've always heard is that Flair didn't want to put the title on him, and Dusty did.
Yeah, I don't know if Dusty did or not. That I can't speak to, because I always find it hard to believe that Dusty wanted to put the title on anybody other than himself, to be honest. But I do think that Dusty probably had a bigger vision for Luger than Flair wanted, and I think Flair, again, Luger's reputation, and maybe to some degree it was a legit thing. Maybe he was a jerk. Maybe he was hard to get along with. I wouldn't be surprised by that in the least. But, you know, my thought is that it really hurt Crockett in 88, especially by the end of the year when the company's spiraling out of control, costs are going haywire, and they're in the midst of, you know, basically selling, because they sold the company, I guess, in November of 88, I think is when the sale went through to Turner.
Even October, actually.
Was it October?
I first read about it in the Pro Wrestling Illustrated year-end issue for 88, and that was out before Starrcade, which was, like, Boxing Day. So
I know it took a while. It took a good while. And it was definitely October or November, and you're probably right. It was probably maybe the middle of October.
Yeah, well, but it would have had, for the news to be in PWI in December, well, of course, no, they might have had knowledge ahead of time, but I would assume it probably would have had to have been 2 months by the time December came, right? So.
Yeah, I know for a fact it was not finalized before that last quarter. I know that for a fact. But the point is, if you look at Luger's trajectory in 88, it's really kind of crazy, because okay, he turns babyface, which we already covered. And then shortly after that, he forms this tag team with Barry Windham.
Yeah.
Maybe not immediately.
The Twin Towers, correct?
Yes, the Twin Towers. And that was a hell of a team. Short-lived, but real good. I mean, everybody remembers the Clash of Champions 1 for two matches. They remember it for Flair, Sting, and that draw, the famous draw that kind of everybody credits with making Sting. And they remember it for the Fantastics versus Midnight's opener, which is kind of a wild brawl, really like a really good sprint. But the title change that night with Luger and Windham beating Tully and Arn is every bit as good as those other two matches. I mean, it's right there in terms of quality. And I think that was one of maybe the first period where you kind of start to see, because see, I never thought Luger, I think looking back, I don't think Luger was bad in 87 by any stretch. But I think at this point you start to see maybe that this guy's actually pretty good in 80,
yeah.
And right around this time, this is kind of the period where you start to see, okay, he's got the look and he sort of has the aura, but he also can work for a guy this size with these features. And not very many guys with those features during that period were well known for being good in the ring. So this was right around the time when that started to happen. And,
yeah. And I will apologize. I've actually been distracted for a couple of minutes ever since I said they were called the Twin Towers because I'm trying to think of what wrestlers had an airplane gimmick. To make a horrible
awful.
Joke.
Awful. Let's see. I can't think of any.
Blitzkrieg.
Oh God. Does Max Moon? No, I guess that's not an airplane gimmick.
Evan
but,
Airborne is almost there, but anyways. We shall go on.
So he's got the, they win the tag titles in that hell of a match. His team with Windham is really a very good team. And then before the team can really take off to the next level, you have the next step, which is Windham, turns and he becomes the fourth horseman.
Yeah,
and,
which
I mean,
that was a pretty awesome heel turn from everything I know.
Oh, it was great. I mean, and Windham was a perfect guy for the group too, and it's another case of Windham and Luger sort of being linked together, and it didn't make Luger look weak. I think in a way it benefited both parties pretty clearly. It's perhaps an example of one of many in Luger's career where something that looked pretty promising was cut off before it could be a big deal, but while all this is going on, too, this is right around the time that Sting is kind of getting his first shot at being a challenger for Flair around the horn. And, it's interesting if you look. Michael Hayes, of all people, was a challenger for Flair a lot in early 88. And then Sting became the challenger. And then right after Sting, Luger steps in. So not too terribly long. I mean, obviously, Luger worked Windham a lot on the house show circuit, including, I think, like some Texas death matches and stuff in 88, which eventually built to his series with Flair in 88, which was really his first marquee main event series, Luger's.
And the one other thing, too, to throw in there is that Luger and Windham were supposed to be in the Crockett Cup that year. But
yeah.
When Windham turned on Luger, Sting was left without a partner because Ronnie Garvin was supposedly injured. He probably wasn't. But perhaps I'm a little suspect, but anyways, they teamed Luger and Sting together and they defeated Anderson and Blanchard in the finals.
Yeah.
And,
exactly what I was referring to earlier.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is a great starring vehicle to get two young guys over. Cause the previous champions are the Warriors and then Dusty and Nikita. And then you have the two young guns win the tournament.
I mean,
that's really good.
And it's another example of sort of Luger and Sting being, two people you think of together at the same time.
Yeah. Probably the first time that they were linked together.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting because, like I said, you had Hayes first as Flair's challenger for a lot around the horn in early 88. And they did pretty good business. Not great across the board, but really good in some cities, which was probably, probably surprising to some people.
I imagine they were fun matches, too.
Oh, I guarantee you they were. And then you had Sting, after coming off the Clash, you know, he kind of had his run. And he had, they had some good dates, but I think it was disappointing and definitely not as good as what Hayes did, oddly enough, which would probably surprise some people.
Business-wise?
Yes. And when Luger came in and got his shots, first of all, I think Luger was a much better opponent for Flair than Sting. You know, we tend to think of Flair and Sting together. I think even Flair sort of thinks of Flair and Sting together because they were the guys who were in WCW for so long and sort of became the identity of the promotion. Sting never left. Flair was the guy who sort of established the company. But if you go back and look, I think the Flair-Luger matches were vastly better than the Flair-Sting matches, pretty much across the board. And
are you including that first major one, the first major 45-minute draw?
Oh, I think Flair Luger, I think that match is really overrated, to be honest. I mean, I think it's a great example of a guy taking somebody who was really limited in Sting, who was repeating his spots every 5 minutes because he just didn't have anything left to do, and making it work. Whereas the Luger matches, Luger was still green. He was probably as green as Sting in many ways. But Luger looked ready in 88. In fact, we may as well talk about this now because we're there. Luger looked so ready in 88 that I actually think it was a big mistake not to put the title on him in 88.
Yeah.
And I think it was
in July of 88, possibly in particular, right?
And yeah. And I think it was compounded in a major way by not putting the title on him later again in 1990, which we'll get to pretty soon. But
Absolutely. Yeah. In
88, when they didn't put the title on, in a way you can understand it because the guy's still green. He maybe isn't that well liked in the locker room. He doesn't have a record as a drawing card, so to speak. But if you look at 88, I want to say he had six dates with Flair in 88 that did more than 10,000, which that we know of, which doesn't sound that great until you look at all of 88, and there might be 12 to 15 dates in all of 88, the entire year, that did 10,000 or more people for Crockett. And if you look at what happens on the back end of that run, when they ran it around the loop the second time and people had seen the screw jobs and they'd seen how the Horsemen were helping Flair win and that Luger was not going to win, the attendance just plummets. Now, one thing you could say is, well, that's on Luger. He drew the first round, the first run around, and the second run around he didn't. To me, I kind of look at that, especially because the exact same thing happens again in 1990. I kind of look at that and I say, these people wanted Luger to win the belt. And not only did they want him to win the belt, but they absolutely didn't want him to lose the way he'd lost on the Maryland State Athletic Commission bit in, you know, in July of 88, which in some ways was a genius finish, I have to say. But it was also, I think, absolutely not the right finish for business.
And I guess I assume anyone listening would understand what that finish was. But I know there's at least probably one person I can think of who wouldn't. Like, one person who listens to the show wasn't necessarily watching then, who's a friend of mine. But, you know, so just to clarify, at the Great American Bash 88, Flair faced Luger, and Luger had Flair up in the torture rack and had a pretty small cut on his forehead.
Yeah,
but the Maryland
even
State... What's that? Yeah.
It
wasn't
so even
the Maryland State Athletic Commission called the match off. That I've heard some reports of that over the years try to indicate that that was like they actually shut it down.
No way. That's complete bullshit.
I think that's just ridiculous. You know?
Now, I can actually see people spinning that yarn after the fact to explain that away because, I mean, well, I was going to shows then. Luger was really hot. You know, there was a big difference between Sting and Luger even then. And I'm going to keep bringing up this comparison because I think it's relevant. There was a big difference between those two even then. Both of them look like future stars for sure, and actually stars in their own right by this point in 88. But Luger had confidence and projected...
Yeah, they look like the future stars is what you can probably say.
Yeah. Luger had confidence. He projected in a way where you believed, like, you believed he could be Crockett's version of Hogan. I mean, that seems insane, and it really is, because nobody was going to be anybody's version of Hogan other than Hogan. But in the sense that you believed he could be their big baby face that they could make a lot of money with. And maybe he wouldn't have. I mean, that's entirely speculative. It's possible that he would have totally collapsed. Sting came across, I mean, I guess the comparison I would make is Sting came across more like a, kind of a clumsy comparison, but Luger came across more like John Cena, and Sting came across more like Randy Orton, to me. And I think in hindsight, even more so. And I don't even mean that as a knock on Sting, because I just think he was greener, and he had not been utilized as well as Luger at that point in a lot of ways. But you can't, at this point, Luger seemed like the guy they should have run with to me in 88. Even as a kid, I thought that. And I think it even more so in hindsight, that this is really the first instance of him being royally screwed by not being given an opportunity. And if you look at the end of the year, you know, the attendance figures just drop dead. I mean, it's just, the company is just, it's unbelievable in the second half of the year, especially toward the very end of the year. It's just, I mean, nobody's coming to the shows. And part of that probably had to do with the turmoil, had to do with Dusty booking and the Dusty finish, had to do with overspended costs, probably less money being put into the actual promotion of events, the fact that they were selling the company to Turner. And I mean, there's a lot of factors. I don't want to say you can blame all of this on Flair not losing the title. I think that's insane to say. But you do get the feeling that that was a real missed opportunity. That's, I guess, what I'm getting at.
Yeah. Do you think they should have, I mean, and then you go towards the end of the year and he faced Flair at Starrcade 88, and which was the first year that they had it not on Thanksgiving. It was when they moved it to after Christmas because of the Survivor Series.
Yep.
And I remember they had the stipulation that if Flair got disqualified, Luger would win. And I was convinced going into that he was going to win the title. And
he didn't. They did this over and over. They did this again in 1990, which we'll get to. But,
yeah.
You know, and the thing is, these are really good matches, which in a way makes it even worse.
Yeah.
Because these guys would go out there and they'd absolutely tear down the house. They'd have great matches. And then at the end, when, you know, everything should be winding down and the you know, you should be transitioning to a real finish, or Luger should be really getting a shot to finally win the belt, some nefarious thing would happen, no matter what the scenario, whether it was Flair loses the title, he's DQ'd, you know, the Capital Combat 90, which we'll get to. There was always something, and it was just, God, it was just a turnoff. I mean, I'll get to me, Capital Combat 90 is the absolute worst, and we're not there yet. But this was pretty bad, because I think Flair won with his feet on the ropes or something. Like, it was just...
Yeah. And he had just managed to sneak in a chair shot there, too, I think.
Yes, it was just an absolute... And another missed opportunity.
I don't think there was a match in 1987, 1988 Crockett that didn't have a ref bump. So,
you know, and the funny thing is, like, as 89 starts, like, here you've had Luger, and he was probably in many ways, he was probably the hottest guy in Crockett. Yes, they'd had some poor shows with him on top versus Flair. But again, I think maybe 6 of the 12 of the 15 matches that did 10,000 plus in 1988 were headlined by Luger Flair. And a lot of the ones that did, a lot of the other ones that did 10,000 had him and Barry as like second from the top. So, which was, you know, kind of a big feud. So, and he's coming off the Crockett Cup win too, which we mentioned. So, 88 was a very good year for Luger. Now, aesthetically, from a purely aesthetic standpoint, I think 89 Luger is one of the really great years in wrestling.
Absolutely.
But, even as I say that, if you look at how the year is set up and how it ends up on the back end and then going into 90, which again, we're going to get to here, it just makes you think, are you kidding me? How in the hell did they screw this up? So, yeah, so we have to match it. Yeah, you got the match at Starrcade, and then, you know, 89.
And then Flair says afterwards that he will never get another shot at him.
Correct. And then in 89, you've got early in the year, he has the match with Well, he actually had a lot of good TV matches right out of the gate in 89. There's a really good match with Kendall Windham in 89 from TV that I like a lot. Completely unheralded, almost unknown match.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but Kendall Windham actually turned on him and joined Barry, right?
That may be the case. Although I don't remember if that happened in this particular match or not.
Well, I'm not sure if it's, I think it's Luger he turned on. But yeah, go ahead.
And then you've got,
keep in mind I wasn't able to watch your TV at this point, so.
He had the really, a match I liked a lot with Barry at Chi-Town Rumble. That's kind of a polarizing match. Some people don't like it.
But
I thought it was really
love
good.
That match.
I thought it was really good. I liked it a lot. And I think, again, this is the thing, like, when you think of Luger, you kind of think of Barry and Sting and also Flair. Those are the guys you think of. And then, again, here he is with Barry. Early 89 Luger is really interesting because I was going to a lot of shows at this point, and they sort of did a drawn-out bit with him turning heel because at first he was just sort of the cocky guy. And by the way, I think Luger is one of the all-time best guys in wrestling history at walking the fence to where you don't know what side he's on. He would be excellent again in 96-97 when he was Sting's tag partner. But he's just really good at this because he is cocky and he isn't very humble, and he definitely thinks he's hot shit, and you can tell. And guys like that, you always sort of wonder with. And in early 89, it was definitely like a slow thing where he started doing some heelish stuff. But I don't think he started bitching more in his interviews, but I don't think he turned overly heel 100% until he ran in on after the Steamboat Funk match at Clash of the Champions 5, maybe? I think it was Clash of Champions 5?
I'm not sure if it was 5, but yeah, that was like June 89.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if this was the match you were talking about, but yeah, he wins the U.S. title from Barry at Chi-Town Rumble,
yes.
One of my favorite shows ever. And he has some interesting title matches, one against Kevin Sullivan, and then, continues with Barry. And then he has a match with Kendall Windham. Actually, I don't know if it was a TV taping, but yeah, it looks like he worked Kendall some. And he actually had a match where you were possibly at this. He had a match where he defeated... Oh, sorry, wrong Charleston. He had a match where he defeated Flair in a U.S. title match, so...
Yeah.
Pretty interesting stuff.
I think this period of 89 is really... Like, to me, Luger in 89 is just great period. I mean, the whole year. But that heel turn was so well built, too, and a lot of the little stuff they did, because going to live shows at the time, there were a lot of fans that still wanted to cheer him, even after he turned heel, but... Not really. It was like, we love to hate this guy. He had that kind of heat, which is hard to even quantify unless you've actually experienced it. If you've never been in a setting where something like that is going on, it's very hard to articulate and explain because it doesn't really have... I mean, I guess the equivalent would be like if you were a diehard fan of, the Knicks, and Jordan comes to the Garden and drops 60 points on you.
Yeah.
You still love him because he's
roles.
So good.
There'd be some film roles that would be very similar, So or TV roles. So.
Yeah, I mean, like Bill the Butcher, maybe from Gangs of New York. One of these guys, you love to hate him, and you can't. He's like I don't know, but Luger definitely had that kind of heat live, and I mean, he really in '89 he just had a hell of a year. As a character,
of my favorite matches is actually his Wrestle War 89 match against Michael Hayes, where Hayes wins the U.S. title. And then, like I say, I was only going by PWI, so I thought Hayes had like a multi-month title run. But I didn't find out till like 2 months later that Luger won it back 2 weeks later and then, started to do a lot of heel stuff then.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really crazy because if you look at the guys who wrestled in 89 for the title, well, first of all, I do want to mention this. One of my all-time favorite TV angles they did from this period was Luger versus South Carolina's own Lee Scott, the famous, semi-famous jobber who actually feuded with Cactus Jack maybe right after this, not too long after this. Luger, they did this bit where Luger came out and was like, oh, you want a U.S. title shot? And I actually can't remember when this happened in the timeline, if this was before he officially turned heel or if this was during the period where he was acting heelish but wasn't a full-blown heel yet. And he made this big deal, like they had this contract signing in the ring, and it was like, oh, this guy's going to get his shot. You know, who would have think that little old Lee Scott's going to get his title shot? And then Luger, they ring the bell, and he immediately just hits him with a cheap shot lariat and pins him.
That's great.
It's one of the most assholish things I've ever seen in wrestling. I remember being just absolutely livid as a kid. You know, because they did such a great job selling this great opportunity for poor old Lee Scott, and then he just gets destroyed in like 2 seconds.
That Lee Scott must be an awfully good sport, or he got paid really well.
Yes, well, he was one of the all-time lunatic bumpers and psycho jobbers during that period as well. But if you look at the guy that Luger worked that year, like, you know, it's very easy. You always say, oh, well, he was carried to good matches. Well, he worked on,
yeah.
I don't believe that at all, but if you look, he worked on a wide variety of people. You know, Kendall Windham, Barry Windham, Tommy Rich. He had a real good match with Tommy Rich on TV, I think at the Clash of Champions in 89. The Michael Hayes match, which is really good, like you said, from WrestleWar. The Steamboat match from the Great American Bash. And, man, that angle where he turned heel was great, too, when he came in and just destroyed him with a chair. But the Steamboat match from Great American Bash 89, which on most shows would be the best match on the show.
Yeah. This happens to be one of the best shows of all time. So.
Yes. On most shows, that would be the best match on the show. It just so happened that was one of the best shows of all, if not the best show of all time, certainly in the United States, up in that top tier. And then, on the back end of the year, he worked a couple of really good televised matches, including a really good match I love at Halloween Havoc with Brian Pillman.
That's a fantastic match.
Oh, it's great.
That may be Luger at his best. Not necessarily his best match, but that's like the best Lex Luger, I think.
He was just so good at projecting that cocky, I'm better than this guy attitude during that period. And it came across in everything he did. And Brian Pillman, as this hot underdog that kind of has interesting offense for the time period, this clean-cut baby face in a lot of ways, was almost the perfect opponent for him. You know, Pillman is a guy I'd love to do a show on in the future. He's one of my five favorite wrestlers of all time, which a lot of people don't know. I still think Pillman is a guy. You know, Luger is probably my number one guy that was screwed over by Crockett, WCW booking. Pillman might be number two. Because they had a lot of shots to elevate him, and this was Luger did a lot of work to make him look really like Brian was on his level during this feud. Pillman did not look out of place at all.
I say Luger made him.
I think in a lot of ways he did. I mean, people would point to, you know, TV matches that Flair had with Pillman. You know, and Flair certainly liked Brian a lot and thought he was a good worker. But to me, this feud kind of really did make Pillman. This made him seem like more than just an underneath guy that was good for high spots, you know.
Made him seem like more than just a guy from Stampede, you know.
Yeah, it made you believe that he was a guy who could wrestle against main eventers and beat him or compete with him, you know. And it was so well done. All this stuff. And the thing, the genius of Luger in 89 is if you run down the list of names we just mentioned, a lot of those guys, Tommy Rich, Michael Hayes, Steamboat on the back end of the Flair feud, Pillman, a lot of these guys maybe not even be seen as main eventers. But when they were in there with Luger, it felt like it was a main event level match. And that is something that is kind of a lost art, too. Like, it's funny, 89 Luger, I think, aesthetically, both in terms of character and as a worker, was his best year. But in terms of where he was on the card, it really wasn't until the end of the year in the Iron Man tournament at Starcade where he was really a main event guy. The bulk of the year, he was taking a back seat to these other guys, you know. And, you know, like for the Steamboat, by the way, the Steamboat feud didn't draw at all. The Funk feud drew pretty well. Not as good as you might think, but it did pretty good for the time period. But
which Funk feud?
The Funk Flair feud.
Flair Steamboat? Flair Funk, you mean? Okay.
Yeah.
I thought you were talking about Luger, and I didn't remember Luger fusing Funk.
So. That's my fault for confusing it, but my point in getting at that is, if you follow the timeline of WCW from the time it was bought out, and, you know, toward the end of 88, like we said, October, November, I think Dave's right, I think it is October, and then go through till Hogan and them came in 94, 95, in that time frame. If you follow that period, the period when it was basically what we would still look at as Crockett, even though it wasn't, because it was still that sort of Southern style wrestling dominated by Flair, Sting, those guys. If you look at that period and look at the feud that drew money, particularly guys that drew money opposite Ric Flair, Luger is probably I would actually almost guarantee without doing the math, but having looked at the figures pretty recently, Luger was the best drawn opponent for Flair from that whole period. And I think that's really telling. You know, some people say, well, yeah, but the wrestling was down and Flair was gone for a couple of years. And that's true. That's not something you can sneeze at. But he was a better drawing opponent than Steamboat. He was a better drawing opponent than Sting. He was a better drawing opponent than even Funk, even though that feud was really hot. He was a better drawing opponent than Vader would be when Flair came back and did all that stuff, too. So there's something to be said for Luger as a challenger to Flair. You know, and we look and say, oh, well, it was Flair who drew. Well, this is one of those examples I was talking about earlier. You could say it was Flair who drew, but how come they didn't come out to see these other guys? You know, like, there was obviously something to Luger, too, so...
Yeah,
anyway.
So, I mean, that's just that negative thing that people always do, right?
Yeah, well, I think Flair was the bigger star. Okay, he was.
Oh yeah,
Flair,
no question.
Flair was the bigger star. He was the guy people really wanted to see, in the sense that he was the guy who had the reputation, the history, whatever. But I don't think it's a coincidence that Luger was his best drawing challenger, and that you saw strong spikes in both 88 and 89 when Luger was when Luger was his opponent. But
and I think it might have been quite different if Flair was in there with Al Perez in 88. So
yes, I think that's fair to say. Now, Dave, do you have memories of the Iron Man tournament?
I do. It's kind of a shame. I mean. I wish it had been its own separate pay-per-view and not Starrcade.
I agree with you 100%.
Because Starrcade was always the super card. And that's really the start of it not being. Because, it was, they had a couple years there where they did Battle Bowl, which was a cool concept in its own, I thought. But just it took away from Starrcade. That being said, it was a pretty good setup with, Flair, Sting, Muda and Luger, and all had matches against each other. And, it was a fun night of wrestling, I remember. And, I think the biggest memory from that show is the Steiners beating the Warriors, actually, Road Warriors. But
yeah, you know what sticks with me, the thing I always remember about that show, and this was a show that I watched live during a period where I didn't get to watch all the pay-per-views live. But what really sticks to me about that show more than anything is that Luger was the only guy who was undefeated. But he didn't win the tournament. And
yeah, because did he have a draw or something like that?
Yeah, he had maybe two draws. But it was one of those things where I remember thinking at the time, even as a kid, like, oh, that's going to be a reason for him to complain and do something later. And the irony is I actually don't even know if that was the plan. I actually don't. A part of me thinks that originally they didn't have a plan for Luger at this point, or not a main event level plan. I think a part of it was like, well, we're giving you this as a concession, but we don't know what else we're going to do with you after this point.
Did he beat Sting in that show? Did he beat Sting on that show?
I can't remember if he beat Sting. All I remember thinking as a kid was that he didn't lose. And that was going to be part of a storyline later, And what's funny is...
The booking mind of 9-year-old Dylan Hales.
That's right. Actually, 8-year-old. I don't know what was going to happen. I don't know what the plan was, but Luger was still a heel, and he was still hot as a heel. He still had traction, you know. And my thought, and I've talked to, I know a lot of people feel this way too. My thought is that they turned Flair back heel too soon. That Flair was still hot as a babyface. He had ideas. People wanted to cheer him. They definitely wanted to cheer him.
I would agree with
that.
They
never should have turned him back heel, at least not then. And that the real money was in a heel Luger versus a face Flair, which had never been done before. That there was, to me, if there was going to be money to be made in 1990 in WCW, that was probably the hottest thing they could have done. But they screwed that up by turning Flair back face. And then they would, and then, you know.
And do you think the money would have also been in putting the title on Luger in that process?
I think very likely yes, because I think Luger had to win the belt. Because at this point, Luger had a reputation of a guy who just couldn't win already. And it was about to get even worse, because then what happens, okay? If you move into 90, and I see no reason not to, unless you get something you want to point out. But
oh, no. I don't think there was any major stuff in between Starcade and here.
But if you move into 90, Luger gets in a position, like, basically, that's another period where, in a way, Luger was kind of in a holding pattern. I believe he still has the U.S. title at this point. He's in the middle of a long reign with the belt here, which would be the longest in history, 500-some-odd days.
Actually, I did want to point out that for the rest of the year, they seemed, after Starcade, they did seem to go with Flair and Luger.
They did do it at the...
On the house show loop.
On the house show loop at the very end of 89, you're right.
Yeah.
To me, that never felt like a real feud, though, because I didn't feel like it had any presence on TV.
No, that was just,
it may be that they went to it because it had been something that had been successful before, by the way. I don't know. But it was clear that the goal was to set up for Sting versus Flair. I mean, that was the clear. And in some ways, maybe that was right, but I still feel like Luger as a heel was the smart thing to do. So what happens? You set it up, and you're building toward it, and they do the angle where Sting gets thrown out of the Four Horsemen in Corpus Christi.
Which was a fun angle.
What's that?
Which was a fun angle.
Yes, well, ironically thrown out by Ole Anderson.
Yeah.
or at least Ole was the catalyst for it. And they throw him out, and then Sting gets hurt that night. So Sting has to get taken out of the picture. So what
climbing
do they do?
The cage.
So what do they do? Luger has to become a babyface again.
Yeah.
Now, in this day and age, with turns as common as they are, I don't think some people who maybe are newer fans may not even think, but this is a lot of turns already in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and the only guy comparable from like the 80s and into the 90s would be Orndorff.
Yeah, I mean, this is basically every year he's turned. You know, like 86, he's a face. 87, he's a heel. 88, he's a face. 89, he's a heel. 90, he's a face again. So, I mean, every single year he's turned. Every year. And sure enough, they put him in basically the exact same position he'd been in 88, which is as the big, muscly Crockett / WCW at this point version of Hogan versus Flair. And... it's the same old shit.
And he was supposed to be a heel U.S. champion defending against Steve Williams on that show, which actually would have been a lot
of
fun.
Yeah, this was probably the best solution, the best thing they could have come up with. But this is another example of, because one of the big things with knocks on Luger for years was that he was a reputation of a guy who was always turning, you know, he turned so many times, the many turns of Lex Luger. And so it's hard to get invested in a character when he's constantly turning like this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
it's hard to legitimately see him as a baby face.
Yes,
especially.
It's very hard to legitimately see him as a baby face. In this case, it was even, in my view, it was actually the worst case of him turning face because it was so transparently obvious that it was just done out of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think he might have saved Sting from an attack or something. Like, there was, like, you know, there was a theoretical reason why, and I believe he saved Sting from attack. It kind of established him as a long-term friend of Sting or something, but there was a theoretical reason why he'd done it. He turned face. And it maybe wasn't even the worst rationale, but the reality is he's coming off this hot heel thing. He was really dynamic as a heel. I still think the money, they never should have turned Flair face in the first place, so he was hurt by that. But then he was also hurt by Sting getting injured, because even though he went on to have these matches with Flair, which were very good matches again in 1990, it was the same type of thing. He's getting, you know, the Horsemen are finding ways to screw over Luger, and he's not winning the title. Not because he's not good enough, but because he's a screw job, basically. And
then, you know, especially building up the Capital Combat, you know, like, they built that as he's got to win the title because there's no way for them to interfere.
Oh, well, you had the Clash match, you had the Wrestle War match. All these matches were good. Wrestle War 90, which, of course, has the all-time great hype videos with the rap, the Wrestle War 90 rap. But
I do have to add something I forgot to mention earlier. One of my real things I liked about Luger at this time, and it's going to sound like it's a bit of a joke, but I totally mean it, is that he had awesome theme music.
Dude, me and Loss were just talking about it. Top five theme music of all time.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely top five theme music of all time. 100% agree. I'm not even going to try and hum it, but it was tremendous. Dude, yeah, it was totally great.
Just beautiful people. Yeah.
maybe even my number two theme after the Midnight Express theme, which is, in my opinion, the best theme in wrestling history by a comfortable margin. But Luger, you know, Capital Combat was the worst of the worst because despite the fact that he was hurt by Flair turning heel, despite the fact that he was forced to turn again and takes Sting's place, these shows were drawing, especially relative to what was going on in 89. You know, they were doing at least somewhat better business, definitely better business than they'd done with Steamboat, definitely better business than they would later do with Sting. So it's not like these were totally bombing. Some of these shows were doing quite well, and certainly by the standards of the era, they were doing quite well. And then you get to Capital Combat and the cage match. And old Ole Anderson or whoever stealing the remote controls to the cage and lifting it up so that the Horsemen can come in. I mean, there are very few angles and things that have happened in wrestling, very few in my lifetime, where I was so angry by it that I really didn't want to watch wrestling. But that was one of them, and I remember after that happened, like in the weeks after at school, because not everybody saw the pay-per-view, obviously, but when it started to trickle out what happened, it was almost universally reviled as complete bullshit, and people were like, fuck this company, even among children. Like, even the kids weren't buying this crap, you know, and to me, that was actually what did Luger in WCW during that first stint. That was the death blow, because he'd been really hot twice. And, I mean, like, basically, despite the fact that he had, you know, was forced into a situation that probably wasn't the best situation, it was a situation that was working to some degree, but the payoff that everybody wanted didn't come. And then it was like, yep, this Luger guy just can't get the job done. He's a second fiddle player, you know. And, you know, he went on and he had some good matches for the rest of 1990. But
I really always liked his match with Mark Callis, a.k.a. The Undertaker, at the Great American Bash.
Yeah, I mean, again, he had a lot of these fun U.S. title matches because he kept that belt. But it
and
just
then,
felt like
then went on belt. Then went on to lose it to Stan Hansen as well, which is, yeah. I don't know, kind
which
of I, a cool little feud, you know.
Well, I like the Luger Hansen match a lot. It's funny because up until recently, I always thought those matches had kind of a negative reputation. And then very recently, I've seen some people who really enjoyed them, which is kind of cool because I always thought they were good. So,
yeah, I like.
But you know, and honestly, Luger and Hansen, I mean, like that was kind of, it's weird if you look at it. As the U.S. champion, that was kind of Luger's role. The guy who was really over and really, dynamic and a really strong character who was wrestling a cornucopia of just bizarre challengers.
Yeah.
And then whenever they got desperate and they needed somebody who they knew could, had done good business in the past, well, we'll put them in the main event.
In September 1990, he had some U.S. title matches against Harley Race, which is kind of interesting. Yeah,
which I didn't know that, but it doesn't surprise me because I know Harley came back during that period. But
yeah,
you know,
and he also had matches where he faced Flair with, you know, defended the title against Flair too. So,
and I don't now you're gonna I don't even know if the rest of 1990 is even worth covering, like because what
well you go into Starrcade 90 where he won the title back from Hansen.
Yeah.
And then he had a lot of matches with Big Cat Curtis Hughes.
So what do you got? But if you think, that's funny. But if you think about it, like, 19, okay, so basically I'm going to jump to 91 now because this is the story of Lex Luger.
we are like an hour and a half in almost, so.
Oh, my God. So we're at 1991, and what do you got now? Well, you got Luger. And they don't know, you know, they got all this chaos going on with Jim Hurt and Ric Flair. Ric Flair's trying to be shunted aside by Hurt. They're trying to renegotiate the contract. Flair doesn't want to do it. All this craziness is going on. They don't know what to do. Luger is, you know, again, another slow heel turn with Luger. It's not immediate. And it builds up to, you know, over the course of this period, it builds up to... The title is he finally wins the title, right? And it's supposed to be him versus Flair.
Just another side note, he had a cool little match there on one of the pay-per-views against Dan Spivey, too. So.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, that was WrestleMania 91 in February. Yeah, so.
So, you know, you're getting to – it's finally going to be the payoff, right? We're finally going to get Luger getting his big win. Nope. Flair, depending on who you believe, walked out, was fired, whatever the case may be. Flair leaves, takes the belt with him, and Luger turns heel yet again after Harley Race instructs him to give the pile driver to Barry Windham in the cage, and Luger finally gets his world title by beating Barry Windham, who'd never been the world champion prior, and really, as much as I like Windham, was lower than Luger in the pecking order, and again turns heel in the process.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, there's some of it, there's some ideas of that that's cool. You know, managed by Harley Race, the bodyguard of Curtis Hughes with Mr. Hughes and stuff. But it was just chaos, you know, at the time. And you know, there was some stuff there that you could have made cool use of, but they sure didn't do it.
No, and I thought Luger did a good job, as good a job as anybody could have done in the position he was thrown into. I really do. I really believe that. I think at that point, he did as good a job as anybody could have done, but nobody was going to do a good job because the crowd didn't like the way Flair left. They were livid over it. And even though a lot of people, I think, did want to see Luger win the title, they wanted to see a pass into the torch moment. They didn't want to see that shit. Like, that's not a knock on Barry Windham. It's just nobody wanted to see that. It was just one of many disastrous moments in the career of Lex Luger that were entirely not his fault. I mean, it was the making of other people and outside factors. But
yeah, I think actually one thing that
what should have been like the biggest moment of his career, I think it's kind of looked at as a joke.
Yeah. I think one thing that we would be remiss in not mentioning is the match he and Sting had against the Steiners for the titles at Super Brawl.
Yes, which is a match I don't love, but for your bomb throw.
Oh, really? Okay. I loved it at the time.
Well, I think, you know, I'm a huge Steiners mark. I always will be, even though I don't think they're the greatest workers on earth. I think they're one of the most fun teams to watch ever because they're kind of like the precursors to your crazy spot-a-thon bomb-throwing psychos, but they were way bigger, so it was more impressive to watch, you know? At least to me, it was more impressive to watch because of that. You know, and that match was really like... It's still really highly regarded, you know, like just the ultimate bomb-throwing sprint between big heavyweights. And the Steiners were cool because the Steiners were that one tag team besides the Road Warriors that you believed could wrestle main eventers and win. Like, most tag teams, you didn't believe that they wrestled main eventers, they would win. You know, like, I at least as a kid, I didn't. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I like
well,
the Rock and Roll
they were probably the first main event tag team act since the Warriors.
Yeah. I mean, I liked, like, the Rock and Roll Express. But I, you know, if the Rock and Roll Express were wrestling Sid Vicious and Vader, I don't think that they're going to win it. Even though they were a better tag team and they had, you know, more technique or whatever. In my mind, I don't believe it. You know, the Steiners you believe. So, yeah. Well, and that, again, this is just, anyway, this is just craziness. I don't want to bog down in too much talk on this. I want to keep moving on, but.
So Luger is champion. I think it's pretty easy to say that one of the highlights of, one of the things that really kind of defines the first few months of his reign is his work with Ron Simmons.
I like all that stuff, and a lot of people don't like it.
I like it a lot.
I mean, some of it was
I seem to remember their match at Halloween Havoc being at least pretty good.
I really like that match. A lot of people don't like it. The Halloween Havoc match, I think it was the 2 out of 3 falls match, right?
Yeah, and the build to it was great.
I really like that.
Harley Race was being, you know, he was putting the race in racist for sure, but.
I always really liked that match, and I never understood why people didn't like it. I mean, I'm not saying it was like the greatest match of all time or anything like that, but for a heavyweight slugfest during that time period, there aren't a lot of matches I can think of that were any better.
I think people just didn't think Simmons was a main eventer, and I think they were wrong. I think that made him a main eventer.
I have mixed feelings on Simmons. On the one hand, I really like him. Actually, probably much more than a lot of people do. On the other hand, I think I don't know that he was ever a main eventer, but I don't. Again, in that period in WCW, it was hard to elevate anybody because
their version of a main eventer. Yeah.
The company was in such a disastrous place that I think elevating anybody would have been difficult. And Simmons probably was a more difficult project than others because he was going to take more time to cultivate, I think, than others. But that's not really his fault. That's just WCW was in such a bad place, I don't know that anybody really could have been elevated in the way you were supposed to during that time period. Seriously, I don't know if it was possible.
Mm-hmm.
That's why
it did happen the next year with Vader, but otherwise, that's a whole other story. But
Yeah.
From there you also have, it was natural that you're going to build towards a feud with Sting. And, you know, I had this whole thing with Sting where something I always thought was cool is the whole, you know, Cactus and Abdullah coming out of the big gift wrap boxes and stuff like that. And they turned out to be from Luger, and he attacked Sting at the Clash. And what we talked about before is a great show. So
I loved all that stuff. All that stuff at the end of 91, setting that up or whatever. I think that was the end of 91. All of that I really liked.
I read somewhere that, I mean, he was seen as being so bored during his title reign that he had a match with someone and, like, went to the crowd and said, "You see why I hate this shit?" And it's like, I don't know. I have fonder memories of it than that. He seemed like a cool champion to me. So
I thought Luger was a vastly better champion than Sting. I mean, like, and again, this isn't even entirely Sting's fault. I mean, yes, you could say Sting had the Vader matches, which obviously Luger doesn't have anything to that degree on his resume, and I think Sting brought a lot to those matches. But as an overall character, I think this is a perfect example. Like, his dismissive attitude, to me, that was part of his character. I kind of understand what people are saying and that he had that sort of demeanor like, I'm above this, but to me that was, like, kind of the point. And another thing to remember about Luger during this period, especially as we get into 92, is he had limited dates on his contract at this point. So he was off TV, and even though he had the belt, not around for big chunks. Because, again, he had negotiated himself a very good deal. he was not present for big chunks of this, heading toward the end of his run with the company. The first company.
Oh, he had to get in time with his children before he became a deadbeat.
So much for sending in the link to the show.
Yeah.
But so I guess 92, yeah. I mean, really, to me, the big thing
really
in 92
it's just a Super Brawl match with against Sting, right?
Yeah, that's the
yeah,
big thing.
Yeah,
I mean,
they had the build up with him where he got eliminated by Sting at the first Battle Bowl. And then basically from there they had the match that, you know, I don't know. What are your memories of that match? Or do you have memories of it being half decent at all?
Sting and Luger?
Yeah.
That's yet another match I like that nobody else likes.
Yeah.
I mean, when I say that I enjoyed Luger's title run, I actually enjoyed, I mean, it by no means was it an all-time great title run. I don't want to give the impression that I feel that way because that'd be completely erroneous. But I like a lot of it. I like the Simmons match. I thought the Sting match was a good match. You know, a lot of people hate it. I thought it was, and I think part of that is the expectation. You have these expectations that were set by Flair. That was the guy that was the champion, and you kind of had your idea of what a title match was supposed to look like based off Flair. And
yeah.
You weren't going to get a Flair match from Lex Luger or from Sting, for that matter. So I think to a lot of people, especially longtime fans and fans, people who've been fans of Crockett beforehand, if you didn't get that type of match, it didn't matter if it was good or bad. It wasn't what you wanted to see. And I can understand that. I mean, to me, personally, I don't feel that way, but I get that. I get the mentality that this is the kind of match that I expect to see, and this isn't what I got, so I don't like it. But to me, it never bothered me because I thought the match was I thought it was a good match.
Yeah.
Not great, but good.
People still do that to this day. You know, very different example, but, you know, people say Ring of Honor sucks because it's not as good as it used to be. It's like, well, but is it good, you know? Same with when ECW came back. It's like, no, it's not like the original ECW. It's like, yeah, but is it good? That's the big thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a perfectly good example.
So
okay.
Yeah, so then you had the build up to the match at Super Brawl 92, and you know, I think it was pretty obvious that Sting was going to win the title, but then Luger just disappears. That was his last match in WCW, and then he shows up. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say I don't want to linger for too long on the WBF because I don't think it matters all that much. But it is,
yeah.
I guess we have to mention the fact that he was in the WWE.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is that WrestleMania, he was interviewed as the new member of the World Bodybuilding Federation. And, you know, I don't know, if you're going to do it, it was cool to do it at WrestleMania, I guess. And, you know, everyone was excited, hoping he was going to wrestle. And I'm not sure, was there a no-compete thing that he wasn't allowed to wrestle for a year, or did he just not give a fuck for a year?
I don't know all the details. I don't know that anybody knows all the details, and I'm sure somebody will chime in and say they do, which is great because I would love to know the details myself. But to my knowledge, I've never heard the official story about all this. I don't know if the plan was that he was going to be just a bodybuilder for a time being with the eventual build to him getting back into wrestling. I don't know if there was a no-compete, although I find that hard to believe because he was still appearing on WCW TV. Plus, he'd negotiated such a cushy contract for himself at WCW, I'd be shocked if he had something like that in there. Another possibility. Well, also,
what did
he
you
had
say?
The motorcycle
he was still appearing on WCW TV, you said? Oh, WWE TV. Okay.
Well, he also had the motorcycle accident somewhere along this period.
Yeah.
Where he had the plate inserted into his arm, which really became the big deal during his WWF run. I mean, I almost don't even want to spend a ton of time on his WWF run because I think it was so inconsequential. But
it's another example of what came of some of the earlier stuff. Is, you know, like,
yes.
You had him debut as the Narcissist, managed by Heenan, basically, because Hennig Perfect had turned on Heenan. And
actually, originally, he was Narcissus. And then he was the Narcissist, but go ahead.
That's funny. And, you had that, you know, what on paper sounds like a good gimmick of having all the mirrors around you and flexing, but it just never really worked. I did see him live during a TV taping of all that and saw him against Bret Hart. But, yeah, so he was feuding with Perfect. They had the match at Mania, and he went over, I believe. And then feuded with Bret Hart after Mania.
Yeah, and most of his matches were built around the plate and the forearm gimmick, which was that, you know, he had to wear this pad over it because people were complaining that he was using it, and then he dropped the pad and cheap shot somebody anyway. So that was kind of the deal.
Yeah.
Which meant there wasn't a lot of the torture rack, which was pretty much what a lot of people loved about. So you took away what a lot of people loved about.
Yeah. And then you go into the summer of 1993. Yokozuna is the new world champion and challenges for anyone to come on to the, what was it, the USS?
USS Intrepid.
I thought so, yeah. And body slam him. And I think most of the male population of North America did show up, except you and I. And all failed to body slam him until Luger chopper helicoptered in and manages to body slam and become a babyface at the time. And he became the All-American.
I love the fact that Luger had a helicopter just like laying around for that purpose.
Yeah, just to do his babyface heel turn and fight for America against a fake Japanese dude.
Yet another Luger turn. So if we're keeping track here, he did. I guess he was technically, I don't think he was technically a face or a heel during the WBF thing. I think he was maybe sort of portrayed as a heel during that period.
He was, he was. Well,
He's been heel for a couple of years now, so that's a good run for him.
Yeah. And then they have what was intended to be like a huge build with the Lex Express. They actually did go across the nation with that, didn't they?
Yes.
And is it seen as a failure because it was not well attended, or it just didn't?
The feud, it really didn't draw. Wasn't a hot ticket. None of that stuff was. But I will say this.
I mean, Lex Express thing. Was it like just he showing up to know people, or was it just?
Oh, I don't know the answer to that. I actually don't know the answer to that. But what I would say about this whole angle is, 93 was probably the absolute nadir of U.S. wrestling. I mean, in terms of being able to draw a crowd, nothing was doing anything that year. I think the theory was. I'm sure part of the theory with Vince was, well, we went with these little guys. Let's go back to our roots and push a guy who's like Hogan. But the whole thing came across as really forced. Really forced. And on top of it, in the build to the big match, was it SummerSlam, Dave? I believe it was.
It was SummerSlam 93. I actually had just gotten home from my basic training in the military.
So you've got the SummerSlam 93 match they build to. You get it. You get there. And guess what? Once again, Lex Luger fails to win the title.
Yeah. Because Yokozuna is managed by Jim Cornette and Mr. Fuji at this point. And he had written into the contract that Luger only got one title shot. And then he wins, but by count out.
Yeah. And then the funniest part about this is, like, after Luger won, they made this big celebratory deal out of it. And it's like, why the hell is he celebrating? He didn't win the title, and he's not going to get another shot. So,
I think perhaps Vince was distracted by his impending possible trip to jail. But
perhaps, but yeah.
That'll get you.
From here, I think it's really we can almost wrap the WWF stuff very quickly because
he was intended to still win the title, and him and Brett were the two guys out of the ring. Together at the same time, and you know, a precursor of Cena and Batista.
Yeah,
the and they both got the title match at WrestleMania 10, and basically, Luger had the first title match and lost with Hennig Perfect turning on him. That didn't turn anything because Perfect didn't actually end up wrestling there. And then after that, the big thing later in 94 was that Tatanka thought that Luger was going to turn on him and join the Million Dollar Corporation. But all along,
but then Tatanka turned.
Yeah. I mean, who would have thought that Luger would actually turn his back on the fans?
But they had to match it
at SummerSlam that year that I remember being pretty fun.
I will say this: it was totally believable that Luger would turn. So you kind of believed it. But during this period, I will say this, during this period, Luger was unmotivated during this period, and I think this is really the period that a lot of people think of when they think of him not being very good in the ring. But I really don't think he was that bad. I think he was maybe less mobile than he had been during the WCW stuff that preceded it. But I don't think he was awful. I just think he was unmotivated, and I don't think he was pushed a lot to care. As far as WrestleMania goes, you know, you've always heard that rumor that Luger supposedly spilled the beans that he was going to win the title, and Vince changed his mind. I don't believe that shit at all. I think Vince saw Luger as a vehicle in the sense that with Luger in the mix, Luger was used as a decoy, I think, for Bret to win the title, especially after Owen beat Bret in the opener in that great match.
That was pretty cool.
I think Luger was used as a decoy, and I think probably at this point Luger realized the writing was on the wall that he was never going to get the belt. You know, and he would hang around for another 18 months. You know, he did the Stars and Stripes thing after the Tatanka feud with Davey Boy.
That was kind of fun.
It was kind of the WWE. I always thought it was the WWF's answer almost to the Steiners, in the sense that you had, even though the Steiners had already, I think, were already either there. Yeah, they were already there. But
yeah,
I think in a lot of ways it was their sort of like super tag team, you know, like. But neither one of those guys were at their most motivated during that period. I think this is probably, I would argue this is actually the low point of Luger's career in terms of stardom.
Absolutely,
You know, I don't think he was completely irrelevant or anything, but he certainly wasn't a big player. And I think, to his credit, he realized yet again that he was in a good position. And so on the very first episode of Nitro, in, I guess, August of 95, or was it August or September of 95? I don't remember. I think it was August.
September, maybe
September 5th. But he walked out on the set at the end of the main event with Big Bubba Rogers and Hulk Hogan in the Mall of America. And I really believe, I was talking to somebody about this earlier, and I really believe this. To me, I don't know if Nitro feels like that big a deal if Luger doesn't show up that night. Because
he absolutely makes it, yeah.
I mean, and that's another example, I think, of Luger. Yeah, he was not the engine that drove it, but he was a kind of a big deal when that happened, because that was the beginning of holy shit, anything can happen.
Would have been September 4th, by the way.
Okay.
September 4th, because the next week.
It was that was the beginning of the whole the Monday Night Wars, obviously, but it was also that feeling of, oh my God, anything can happen on these shows. You know what I mean? Like, that was the first time you really, really felt that way in wrestling, really, in probably several years. And
I know when I'd seen that they were going to be starting a show, I was like, what are they thinking? They're going to get killed.
Yeah.
And then look what they did, right?
Yeah, Luger jumped ship, you know. I think he wrestled for WWF like 8 or 9 days before. You know, it was kind of a thing where Vince didn't know he was going to jump. So, and he, you know, immediately was kind of put into the, you know, he ended up joining the Dungeon of Doom shortly thereafter, which was kind of a weird bit, but I thought that the jump itself was a perfect example of Luger maybe not being the main guy, but being in an important role that I don't know anybody else could have done.
Yeah. And then on the second Nitro, perhaps they should have saved it for a pay-per-view, I don't know, but he wrestles Hogan.
Yeah. Which probably maybe should have been saved for pay-per-view, but whatever the case may be, I think
it did establish Nitro. So
yeah, I think it was exactly, and I think 95 is an interesting, like, 95. I don't like it's a kind of a year like 87 with Luger, where I think he was sort of in a holding pattern, and then as they moved forward in the year, I think if I'm not mistaken, at the end of the year he was at Starrcade in the tournament versus New Japan. I think he beat Chono in that tournament, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I'm trying to look it up here now.
And I think he was then in the match, the triangle match with Flair and Sting, which set up Flair winning the title in what I regard as the last true Stand of the Horseman, when he beat Savage in the aftermath.
Both of those things, so.
That was the last time the Horseman actually looked like the Horseman to me, was that night. When they ran in and Pillman used, I think, Jimmy Hart's megaphone to bloody up Savage, and Flair ended up winning. But Luger was in the triangle match before that, if I'm not mistaken. So, yeah, kind of a, I mean, he was in the main event scene. You know, he was doing that kind of stuff. But when I think, and Dave, you probably, I don't know if you agree with me on this or not, but when I think of Luger after the comeback to WCW, like we kind of encapsulated Florida with a few things. When I think of Luger after the comeback to WCW, I actually think of three things. Well, four, I guess. The first, Nitro, which we've already covered. His partnership with Sting, which I thought was brilliant, the way they did
it. Yeah, they won the tag title from Harlem Heat at the Clash in January.
Yeah, and they did this whole thing where Luger was like, he would walk down to the aisle, and when Sting looked at him, he'd clap hands with the fans, and then as soon as Sting turned the other direction, he'd quit doing it and kind of scowl at people.
Just
and
brilliant.
you kept waiting for Luger to turn, because now he had this reputation as this guy who was going to turn any second, you know. And you couldn't trust him. He turned a million times. But he never turned.
Like, and his performance of that stuff was really good.
Oh, it was excellent. Because you believed at any moment, literally, you believed he everything about him told you he was going to do it. The way he was acting, his performance, like you said, but also his history. And he never turned. He stayed loyal to Sting, which I thought was awesome. I thought it was absolutely awesome that the payoff was that he stayed loyal. You know, like that, because you were just waiting for the other shoe to drop. And Sting is like the most turned on guy in history. That's the running joke. And Luger didn't do it. he stuck by his buddy. I thought they were a fun team. I thought that whole period. And I thought Luger, you know, he did some other weird stuff. I think there was actually an episode of Saturday Night where he beat Johnny B. Badd for the TV title and then promptly lost it back like a few days later. Which is really weird that they would do that.
Actually, he beat William Regal for it.
Did he beat Regal for it and lose to Johnny B. Badd? I know.
Might be it, but I know he held it for quite a few months.
There was a period in there. There was a period in there where he had like a hotshot title reign. I thought, and I thought it was in '97, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, no, you're okay. So you're right. He did win the title from. I'm trying to see when he wins the title here. I'm quite sure he won it from Regal.
I wouldn't doubt that.
Oh, no, you know, he beat Johnny B. Badd for it. But Johnny B. Badd won it back. And then Luger won it back from him, I think.
That may be it. All I remember is that in 97 he had this weird period where he had like a lot of stuff going on. And some of it was with main eventers, and some of it was with more like peripheral guys.
And he also had at the Great American Bash.
Maybe 96.
Right. In 96 was a really good show. He had the title match against the Giant, who had just won the world title, and he actually got him up in the torture rack, which
was impressive, now. Which was the awesome move that everybody loved, like as a kid, you know, the most copied move ever. But the other things I think of too, because I don't want us to be on the phone for 5 hours discussing Lex Luger, but the other things I think of when I think of his WCW run, are Bash at the Beach '96, because in the build up to that, you know,
he was the obvious pick to join the NWO.
Oh, of course, and you know, even though the rumors were already out there. If you were a subscriber to the newsletters or online, there weren't a ton of people online. I was, but not a whole lot were at the time.
Yeah,
but if you were
a
subscriber, if you were a subscriber to the newsletters, which I was at the time too, you kind of knew that Hogan was a possibility, if not a strong possibility. But I think in the back of everybody's minds, everybody thought there's no way Hogan's actually going to do this. You know?
Yeah, I know.
And Luger was the consensus safe pick. And this is yet another example of Luger, I think, being... He's not the catalyst, he's not the key guy, but he was an integral part of that storyline because he was the decoy, just as he had been at WrestleMania 10. And when they did that bit where he hit his head, you know, and was taken out of the match, even at that point, even though he'd been physically involved with Hall and Nash in the match, you still kind of thought he's going to come back and turn on him. You know, like...
Yep.
And
it was what made sense, right?
Yeah. And to me... Especially because he was the first guy who jumped, because the whole narrative was that Hall and Nash had jumped from WWF. Well, Luger was the first guy to jump. He did it on the first Nitro. So, to me, that was just, the way he was used and the way he was played during that period, plus that was during the period where him and Sting were, you know, were they friends, were they not, what's going on, is he going to turn on Sting? The whole thing was genius. I thought Luger's role in that is the most underrated role in that entire angle. People talk about everybody. I'm not saying he made the angle. That in no way is that true. But his role really made the angle better.
He was important.
He made a good angle. He made what would have been a great angle even better, maybe an excellent angle, if you want to talk about that. But that's the other thing I really think of Luger. And then the other thing I really think of Luger before you start to get to the Russo era and all that, I really think of when he beat Hogan for the title on Nitro in 97.
That might have been his biggest moment.
I think it was the biggest moment in his career. That was the moment everybody wanted to see. That's the moment everybody had wanted to see since 1988.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but ratings were huge for that.
It was an extremely highly rated segment, yep.
Yeah, and then I think the buys were good for the pay-per-view where he lost it back to Hogan.
Yeah, I think he lost it just a few days later at Road Wild or Hog Wild, whatever they were calling it at the time.
Yeah, that's what happened. And, you know, I thought that was shitty.
Well, I understand why Hogan had to have the belt. I understood it, but that was the first time that anybody had, during the NWO era, that the NWO had been beaten decisively. It was Luger, of all people, who'd done it. And he done it decisively, and there was no question about what happened. And it was a great moment. And it was also another example of a moment that kind of mattered a lot, because not only did it get a big rating, not only is it something that everybody remembers. Tons of fans from that era still remember that moment, and my talking to them anecdotally. But it also gave you hope. I think that was right around the time when the NWO storyline was starting to overwhelm people. People were like, is WCW ever going to win anything? And
this was the D-Day before the Hiroshima that was StarCraft 97.
But seriously, Luger doing that, I think, actually was a reprieve to that storyline. It gave it more life. You know, it was a key thing to happen. And, I mean, Luger did some other interesting stuff in here, too. You know, he had that match where he teamed with, I guess, the Giant against Rodman and Hogan, maybe?
Yeah, that was really fun.
I really thought that was a lot of fun. That's another example of a Luger match that a lot of people didn't like that I thought was really fun.
That was another example of stuff in WCW that was really cool. You know, like everybody was talking about that.
And I actually liked Rodman in wrestling. Like, most of those guys they brought in as side figures, I really didn't like. And Rodman at times was pretty bad when they brought him in. But at other times, he was really good. And his character and mentality was a perfect fit for the NWO. With a lot of those other guys, it felt like a stretch. With Rodman, it really just felt like a logical thing. Like, I can believe this.
Well, in 99, I think it was, he had a match. Like, I never saw it, but it was on a pay-per-view, and I guess he just felt like a normal part of the roster at that point. And then he fell off the cliff in his later appearances.
But. Yeah. But Luger, you know, during this time period, he was in the mix with a lot of different guys. But I think the big things to take away from 96, 97, all the way up until the NWA Wolfpack stuff, which is really where I think, as a figure, he started to become irrelevant around that time. But
WCW did.
What's that?
Well, I mean, other than the Goldberg stuff. But.
Well, I mean, he did a lot of stuff. Again, I was talking to Charles X right before I went on the air. And he made the point that he thought Luger was one of the only guys that kind of overcame Russo booking. That Luger was one of the few guys that actually was funny in Russo book skits. He kind of made the most of the stuff he did with Duggan and some of these other guys. And I can actually kind of see that. I remember thinking that when he sort of redid the narcissist gimmick, it was pretty funny and pretty entertaining. I remember thinking that...
it was the main event.
Yes. I remember even his tag team with Buff Bagwell being oddly entertaining, considering it was him and Buff Bagwell.
Yeah.
I remember him having really good matches with Bret Hart. Like, not out of this world great, but during a period where WCW was almost never having good matches anymore, especially with guys who were main eventers. I remember him having two or three TV matches with Bret Hart that were real good. I mean, like, legit, and in no way were they Bret Hart carry jobs at all. Like, it was like Luger was motivated again and was really busting his butt. So, even though I feel like, to me, when I think 97, that moment when he won the title from Hogan, probably was his career peak. That was the thing people wanted. And when he didn't get the lasting run afterward, I don't know that he was ever quite seen the same way again. But, you know, he did do a lot of entertaining stuff as WCW wound down. I think this idea that he just fell off the cliff into being a terrible wrestler when he went to WWF the first time around, which is what a lot of people will tell you, is completely false.
Yeah.
I don't think that's true at all. I think he
got blown up. I mean, but let's say one thing. This guy was monstrous by the time 2001 came around.
Oh, sure.
He was just blown up to the gills. But, you know, that was wrestling at that time. And him and Buff Bagwell had the matches a lot with Sean O'Hare and Chuck Palumbo, who,
yep.
I don't know, I think they get a bum rap. I really like them as tag champs. I think they could have done something with them when they came in the invasion. But
one of the things with Luger is I actually think he still had a good bit of value to WCW at the end as they were trans. You know, I mean, like, there's a lot of what ifs with WCW that stayed around. But I think, you know, I think he still had a good bit of value to that company because he was a guy that didn't seem to mind working with the young guys. He didn't see. I mean, like, his. It's odd because he has this reputation of being kind of a stuck up dick, and maybe he was. But I don't think he really minded working with the young guys. You know, some of the other guys, you get the impression they really didn't want to do it, and sometimes they didn't do it. With Luger, I don't think he cared. Like, I could see him being a guy who could have been used in a very, again, as he was often used, to put over or help maintain other guys and to help cultivate them into bigger stars. You know, and I think he probably would have done it. I don't think there would have been a lot of resistance to it. Now, when his contract was up, he might have said, "That's it, I'm not re-signing." But I could see Luger being a guy who would have worked with those guys, especially at that juncture in his career. You know, there was a lot of stuff during the back end. Go ahead.
And perhaps he could have been some star power for the invasion.
Yeah, very possibly. You know, I mean, Luger's a weird guy. In some ways, I feel like, despite all the criticism you've heard of him over the years, I think maybe his biggest problem and the thing that haunted him the most in wrestling was he was a guy people always wanted to see succeed, but because of the fact that he constantly failed, nobody believed in him.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets to a point where it's like, why invest in this guy if the companies aren't going to invest in him? Sure, he's a good character. Sure, he has good matches. Sure, he has a cool look. But every time we get excited about him, he either turns good or turns bad or he can't win the big one, you know.
And that's where 1997, the title win, just becomes such a big deal.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and that's why in a way it's a real shame that he didn't get a longer run later. Even I understand why they needed Hogan to have the belt back. I get that. I get it.
Even if they could have stretched it out for a month, though.
Well, I think the theory, though, was you had to build toward the Sting match, you know. And if Hogan didn't have the belt heading toward the Sting match, then why the hell were they building for the last year? I mean, I understand the rationale behind it.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, he still could have had, like, a solid 5 months with the title, if Luger had won it back and held it for a month or so.
My thought was more that even after the fact, it would have been nice to see him have, like, a meaningful run in 98 or 99. But by the middle of 99, that company was done for. You know? Like,
yeah.
I mean, and like, you know, you look at stuff like...
He could have been a good opponent for Goldberg.
Well, he was an opponent for Goldberg in 2000.
I was thinking more 98, you know.
Oh, sure. But my memory is that in 2000, he actually... The stuff around the build to it, I think, was actually pretty decent. Although I'm going off faded memories, and the standards of what was decent in WCW in 2000 were admittedly low. So,
yeah.
But, you know... I think I look at stuff like the NWA Wolfpack, which we didn't really mention, but I guess I'll just mention very briefly right now. Luger was fine in that, you know, and I thought it was cool that he was the guy who eventually convinced Sting to join. To me, that was kind of a nice piece of continuity because they'd been friends for years, and he didn't turn on Sting when he could have, and even though they had the falling out with the fake Sting and all that crap.
It was a really big deal when he joined the Wolfpack.
Yeah, and it was presented as a big deal, and it was kind of, you know, It didn't mean anything to me as a fan, because by that point, the NWO thing had already completely jumped the shark to me. But Luger was
you
a
don't,
kind of...
You don't mean John Tenta.
No, I don't. But by that point, they'd already sort of, like... I guess what I'm getting at is, even if Luger, a lot of times, he just seemed to be a guy who never got credit for the good things he did, no matter what it was. If you wrestled Ricky Steamboat and had a great match in Great American Bash, oh, it was all Steamboat. Then years later, we find out that Luger called the match, and people still say somehow Steamboat was responsible for it. Like,
and I'd never even heard that, right? So.
If he draws a big run of stuff with Flair, oh, that's all Flair. Nobody cares about Luger. You know, like, if he, you know, has a big moment on TV, like the Hogan thing, oh, it's just a flash in the pan. That's kind of, I think the story of his career is a lot of people, maybe because of his reputation of coming up short all the time, never giving him credit for...
You know what I think it is, too, though, Dylan, is, like, I think it's really a part of that smart culture coming out, where they, you know, emphasize work rate over the muscled-up guys, and they were seen as, like, a product of the 80s and stuff. Even
That's
though,
true.
As much as we all love Benoit, I think we were kind of masked to just how massively muscled that guy was by the fact that he wasn't a tall guy.
Yeah, I mean... And that's true. I think that's part of it. I definitely think that's part of it. I think there's a lot of factors for why Luger has kind of not gotten his due. But
there's been a lot of like kind of turnaround on him in recent years.
Well, yeah, because you had obviously everybody knows the thing with him and Liz. And I don't know the details of what happened.
I just wanted to mention briefly that he did have a last little run in with the WWE and. 2001 had some title matches with Sting. I'm wondering if any of that was half decent. Probably not, but
probably not.
Because
I can't see those guys being motivated to work very hard. But
yeah, and then he had some matches going into 2006, and then 2003 was a real he was with Elizabeth by this point, and that's a really sad story.
Yeah, And I don't know that anybody will ever know the whole truth again on that situation. I mean, I know there was domestic abuse, or at least I'm pretty sure there was domestic abuse beforehand, or at least allegations of it.
There was. I mean, it's documented. And one of the things that you definitely need to give Luger is I think he's quite held himself accountable on all of that. Like, I just remember
by the standards of most wrestlers, for sure.
Well, yeah, but I mean, in the post-Benoit world, when he was interviewed, I mean, he was promoting his ministry and whatnot, but I just remember him talking about the whole thing with Elizabeth. Maybe he didn't take responsibility on the domestic violence stuff, but at the very least, when he was talking about the amount of drugs that he was doing, and he said, "Do I feel like I might be responsible for that, for her death? You know, having that much drugs in a small little woman like that? Yeah, I do." You know, and he's crying when he says it, you know. Like, that's much more insight than probably I've seen from almost any wrestler, so.
Yeah, and that's fair. And, I mean, you know, for those who don't know, I guess Liz died of basically a drug overdose, and a lot of people have blamed it directly on Luger.
They were both living a very, you know, they were both way out there at that time, you know. So.
Yeah, and I think it's unfair to blame it entirely on Luger, but I also think it's unfair to say that he wasn't culpable. So,
yeah, exactly.
And in any event, he's definitely, you know, and he seems to have turned his life around. He's got the book out, which again, it doesn't look that appealing to me. But by all means, if people are Lex Luger fans, or if they're just looking for a quick read or maybe filling in the gaps, they should check it out because I know it's out there available.
Well. And in 2007, he had that stroke where he was, like, paralyzed for a period of time.
And he was totally estranged from his family for a while, you know. I mean, Luger, in a lot of ways, was kind of like Jake the Snake Roberts. You know, he was a guy that was this big star in wrestling who just is completely estranged from his family, had a lot of drug problems, a lot of health problems that were directly linked to the drug problems, got really... You know, but I will say that, you know, and he appeared this year, I guess, in TNA, or was it last year, inducting Sting into the Hall of Fame. He did do that, too. And that was the first public appearance he'd made on a wrestling program in God knows how long. And it wasn't even actually on TV, I don't think, but I think it was taped.
Yeah, and I know he'd done a thing, too, where was it Green Ant who was doing the kind of Lex Express parody in Chikara?
It might have been.
Lex got wind of it and did, like, filmed a promo encouraging him and put it on YouTube. So, I mean, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, he seems to have got some control over his life, and that's great. I mean,
yeah.
I'm really happy. I do kind of want to talk a little bit about, just briefly again, because we're like at 9 hours or whatever, but about his historic legacy, because, you know,
is he Gus Sonnenberg, do you think? Is he Gus Sonnenberg?
No, he's not a Gus Sonnenberg.
He's not as big as Gus.
No, no way. I mean, Sonnenberg was the biggest draw in wrestling for several years and really changed wrestling in a lot of ways. To me, Luger is an interesting wrestler. I don't think he's a Hall of Fame guy. You know, if you're talking about something like the Observer Hall of Fame, which we obviously have talked about a lot on the show and will be again
very shortly.
But, you know, I don't think he's a Hall of Famer, but I actually think he's a better candidate and a guy more worthy of being in the discussion than a lot of guys who have been.
And he certainly would never be a slam dunk, yes, Hall of Famer. But
no,
I don't think he's a slam dunk, no.
I would vote no with very little hesitation, to be honest. But I will say this, you know, and this is, I swear this is not a direct jab at you, Dave, and I've made this comparison before.
Edge.
I think if you consider Edge a Hall of Famer, especially if you see Edge as a slam dunk or a near slam dunk, as some people do, it's very hard for me to see how Luger isn't pretty close to lateral to Edge. You know, I mean, like, if somebody wanted to argue that Edge was a better candidate, I think a lot of that has to do with the aesthetics of what people look for in a wrestler. But if you're, I think it would be very hard to make a case that Edge was a vastly better candidate than Luger, I think would be my point.
Yeah, no, I'd say they're pretty comparable.
Yeah, and I think the point in all this is, while Luger was, he may have never been a star, but he was a guy who really seemed to dance around really important moments in wrestling. And he
was definitely a star. He just wasn't the biggest star in wrestling.
He was never the biggest star in wrestling. There was a point in time where he probably... He was the ultimate missed opportunity in a lot of ways. You know, he was a guy who, I actually think he's a better Hall of Fame candidate than Sting, which I think is probably controversial to a lot of people. But, and I don't think by much. I think it's pretty close. But I think he's probably a better Hall of Fame candidate than Sting. And I think he's an interesting figure to look at as kind of a comparison with other guys. You know, we always talk about benchmarks and guys you sort of compare to other candidates and other people. You know, I wouldn't say Luger's the cutoff, because I actually think he's, I don't want to say considerably below the cutoff, but he's below what I would consider the cutoff. He just didn't have enough hot money-making runs, whether it was his fault or not. But I do think you got to be clearly better for Luger than Luger as a candidate for me to take you seriously. And as a historical figure himself, I think he's a guy where... I think in 30, 40 years, when we have the benefit of hindsight, I think a lot of people are going to look back and say, man, did Crockett fuck up with this guy? Did Crockett and WCW fuck up with him? I think, unfortunately, the legacy of Lex Luger is going to be a guy who should have been a no-brainer Hall of Famer and wasn't. That would probably be how I would sum it up. He should have been a no-brainer Hall of Famer and he wasn't.
And things that are definite are that, you know, if you have a young guy, a young, you know, muscle-bound kind of guy in wrestling now, and you want someone for him to study, give him 1989 Lex Luger.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Because you're not, I'm telling you, you know, and 89 was a loaded year. I mean, all over the world it was a loaded year. You had guys all over the place. Eric Embry in Texas had a tremendous year in 89. Jumbo in 89 was excellent. Eric Embry in Texas. You had Flair,
Deuce.
Steamboat, Funk. I mean, tons of guys.
I've said Zeus twice and you haven't heard me.
What'd you say?
I've said Zeus twice and you still haven't reacted. So.
I thought you said who.
I'm just going to keep saying it until you do.
I thought you were referencing Jim Neidhart. No. But
I think you thought I said who, but I said Zeus.
The point is, there's a lot of guys in 89 who had really good years.
No, 89 was just a... And especially
Luger,
in that company, you know.
Luger really doesn't feel out of place with those guys, though. You know, and I mean, that's really a testament to how great he was, is that he feels like a major, key, integral, super important part of that year, as opposed to just a guy who just happened to be doing good stuff. And there was a big difference between those two things.
Yeah. And speaking of things that were key, I just remember the, you know, yes, Great American Bash 89 was one of the best shows of all time. Also, probably one of the best countdown shows of all time with Jim Ross. And just remember him talking about Luger with his heel turn and Luger doing the interview, rubbing his hands together, saying about Steamboat, a good big man will beat a good little man every day.
Yep.
And Jim Ross just standing there, like, saying with such disdain about how this is the most pompous, most arrogant man I have ever seen. And he just made him seem like the biggest heel on earth. And he probably was.
And honestly, when all is said and done with Luger, I hope people remember him for 89. You know, like, it's ironic because in a way he was the guy who should have been the super babyface that won the title and kind of carried the load. At least in some, you could argue that. But when I, you know, if I were to say this is how I want Luger to be remembered, it would be 1989. Absolutely.
Yeah.
No
and Luger's 89 is a lot better than most people's best year, so.
Yes. No question about it.
Well,
so
we've managed
that's
to overtalk yet another topic, my friend.
this was a much-requested show, though. This was a much-requested show.
Yeah,
I know.
I was really excited to do this show. I'm actually really excited to go back and watch some Luger now.
Me too. I really want to do it. But this was a much-requested show. And by the way, if people have requests, I'm not saying we will
do. Oh, yeah.
For sure, but we will at least entertain the notion, you know, and I think there's probably a good shot we'd be willing to do them. So if people have requests, you know, if they shoot us a message on Facebook or if they want to post something on one of the various forums Dave and I go to or even shoot us an email, do it. I'm open to anything within reason.
Yeah, I mean, I have the email set up, wrestlingculture@hotmail.com, so... Yeah, fire us an email if that's the only if you don't have any of those other options. If you're not one of the 25,000 Facebook friends I have who I don't know, you can get us to that email address. So.
And don't send him any nude pictures of Ranger Ross.
I'm all stocked up on those.
On that note, Dave, it was fun as always speaking with you.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll be speaking in a few minutes. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And, definitely, you know, anyone who has requests, I would love to entertain that kind of stuff. And requests for careers to cover, that would be great. Thanks for listening. And I would like to note that we are, like, about 4 episodes away from number 50. So I think we should try to plan for something cool for that one.
We'll plan something extravagant. That very may coincide with our second year anniversary too, because I think their second year anniversary is in early to mid September. So,
it's and again, you better get me something this year. So,
all right. On that note, I'm going to go brainstorm stuff to get Dave. Everybody, thanks for listening. Have a good night.
Yeah. Take care.